Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Well, it's an expensive business, you know, to run an army, a navy, and an air force. But some might argue, some cynics, that it's rather important in an island nation. What do you think? This week's Hear Hear show looks exactly at that very issue of defence.
I want to be crystal clear about one thing. Our forces will get the support they need. However great our difficulties, nothing will be done that would compromise current operations.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
The first duty of any government is to protect its people. It's a basic tenet, and most nation states bear that one in mind. So too would the coalition government argue that we do here in the United Kingdom. But how do we get that balance right in the changing face of global security? Later we'll be chatting with Michael Yardley, a contributing author to the Oxford History of the British Army, himself a retired British Army officer.
We're now going through that boundary. We just don't have enough people. We are in a dangerous situation.
And with some words of warning, Labour's Shadow Defence Secretary Jim Murphy will be with us too a little later. But in the meantime, joined in the studio by Colonel Bob Stewart MP. He's the Conservative Member of Parliament for Beckenham, member of the Defence Select Committee. Defending our people and our shores, are we getting that balance right, Bob?
We're trying to get it right, Sean. The fundamental problem is that we should probably have more. Our defence forces are now smaller than they've almost ever been, and yet we face continuing threats.
Talk to us about your history. Yourself, the holder of a Distinguished Service Order as well. Indeed, a very illustrious career in the Army.
Well, I'm the son of a very distinguished officer, gallant, with decorations. I joined the Army when I was 17 and three quarters. I served for 28 years in the Army. I was in the infantry in the Cheshire Regiment, and I ended up as a full colonel. I commanded the 1st British Battalion that went into Bosnia. I did six tours in Northern Ireland. After I left the Army, I went into business for a while, and in 2010, I was elected as the Conservative Member of Parliament for Beckenham in Kent.
I remember bumping into you on the terrace of the House of Commons. I must have known you sort of 7 years or so by then. I didn't realise you were even running as an MP, but you've got quite an interesting story as to how that happened.
Well, yes, I was running, for no money, I have to say, as a service charity, and I was talking in support of the Royal British Legion to about 300 or 400 people. But afterwards, some of the old soldiers came up and said, "We think you should be an MP." And I said, "Rubbish. I don't think I'm right." But it did put the thought into my head. When I said I'd be a Tory, their response to that was, "Well, we don't care what you are. Get in and represent the armed
forces."
Do you
care what you are? It's an interesting point because you are a very independently minded MP.
Yes, I do care what I am. I'm a Conservative by nature, you know, in my heart and soul. I like what's happened in the past. I think it's very important that we look after those people that can't help themselves and we encourage those that can to do as best they can. That's our responsibility, and that is perfectly good Conservative philosophy. And those people that sometimes suggest that Conservatives don't care about the little people, that is absolute rubbish.
Sticking on the issue of defence, do you speak ostensibly as a retired army officer on the issue or as a Conservative MP?
I speak as both, of course. All of us are the product of our history and experience. We all look at things through glasses that metaphorically change our view. But equally, I am a politician now, so it does allow me to think like a soldier, and it does allow me to think like a politician. And, you know, sometimes there is a clash there. As a politician, you want to spend the minimum you can on defence, but as a soldier, you want to make sure that we actually spend more than enough to make sure that we have a decent insurance policy. Those two influences blend together.
Well, they can do. It depends what the overriding principle is. Of course, the charge is that it's not necessarily strategic necessity in what's right and what's wrong, but the maximum amount of money that you can save. And of course, we could turn to our amphibious capability as demonstration of that, couldn't we?
Well, yes.
Which doesn't exist anymore.
Well, hang on. We're talking about the possibility of aircraft carriers. The problem was our aircraft carriers were old and were running out of steam, literally. It is important to have at least one aircraft carrier from which we can mount expeditionary warfare. NATO's now talking about something called a framework nations,
sure,
around which you can coalesce other nations. The framework nations in NATO are probably the French and the British in Europe, and of course the United States across the Atlantic. But it's great that we have the possibility of making some form of coalition that could work slightly independently of the United States if necessary. The French do too, but these would not be very big operations, Sean.
Well, they won't be big operations, and you hit on a really interesting point with NATO, of course. We spend as a proportion of our GDP just at the moment, pre the comprehensive spending review, it might be less. Philip Hammond, the Defence Secretary, was asked fairly recently whether he could guarantee that we would not drop below the 2% budget for defence of gross domestic product. And indeed, the United States have made representations that that would be a bad thing. That's what's considered by NATO to be what ought to be spent. So what is our future with NATO if we cut?
Well, I mean, we may be cutting, but other nations have cut before and are well below 2%. 2%'s some kind of symbol. Actually, I would much prefer it to be 2.83% of our gross domestic
product. Well, 30 years ago, it was 5.9% of GDP.
Absolutely. But here's the problem. Mm. A soldier would say we need it to be 5% to actually guarantee the security of our country. Mm. A politician would actually agree with that in principle. But at the same time, the politician has got to say, well, if you have 5%, which particular hospitals do you want not to have? And that's the conflict.
Actually, to be honest with you, it's a bit unsettling when politicians do this. But I imagine if you've got to control a budget where either welfare, and I'm talking about, you know, the rhetoric here, not necessarily the principle, or whether it be international aid, 0.7% of GDP. If we're saying that a percentage of GDP are nothing more than symbolic, that would surely be the case of international aid.
Well, yes. Well, I mean, David Cameron is totally sold on the idea of this 0.7%. I'm less solid on it. The truth of the matter is, I have seen aid poorly delivered too often in my service career. If you actually want to deliver aid, in my view, you've actually got to almost stand there and watch people put it down their throats. And that's the sort of thing that I feel strongly about.
What I don't like is
the idea that people either ground dump and rely on the local people, the local mayors in my case, thinking of who were actually closely linked to the mafia. And before you know it, they were selling this stuff. So I actually like to ensure that any aid is almost 100%, as close as we can, gets through to the intended people who it's designed to help. Quite frankly, there have been far too many instances in the past of, say, the leader of an African country who often feels, I am the president of this country. Everything in this country I own, and therefore when people give me aid, it's my aid, and I'll decide what I do with it. And by the way, when I sell it, the money will go to offshore accounts somewhere in Switzerland or some island somewhere. Now, that's the sort of thing that makes the British public sick. It has happened in the past, and it might happen in the future.
All right, on defence, Bob, let's bring in Michael Yardley now. He's himself a former British Army officer. He's a contributing author to the Oxford History of the British Army, and a man who's seen a bit of service, indeed kidnapped in Beirut, Mike.
I wasn't in the army then, though, happily. I was actually a war reporter in those days, in fact, starting out taking pictures of war, and I was working for Time, the US magazine, as a conflict photographer. It is a pretty scary moment when you're first taken, and, you know, you've got people sticking AK muzzles in your head, and pretty scary stuff. But happily, in those days, they didn't tend to cut people's heads off, and it was much more of a secular deal than it is now.
On defence generally, here in the United Kingdom, we're an island nation. We currently don't have an amphibious capability. Our numbers are dropping lower than they have. What would you say about our resilience, Mike?
Well, I think the thing that I'm sure Bob will have his opinion on this too, but if you look at the days when I was in the army in the 1980s and indeed the 1970s, our forces now are a fraction of what they used to be. I mean, we used to have over 200,000 in the army. Now we're probably well under 100,000.
Oh, and we're going down to 80,000 by 2020.
82,000.
And the question is that enough, guys? Is that enough bayonet strength to actually do the job? And I don't think it is. I think we're overstretched. The system just can't cope with it. And not just that. The question is, do we have enough people to defend the nation? And I don't think we do.
Well, no, we don't. I agree. The problem is that the pressures on our budget is so enormous. Not trying to defend it. I'm trying to stop it going further. We're actually, the plan is to go down to 82,000 regular soldiers with 30,000 in the reserves. I just don't believe we'll have 30,000 deployable people. An army, to be worthy of the name, should be more than 100,000. We'll be 82,000 people ready to go. I mean, that's not enough, I agree.
You see, I mean, this figure of 30,000 in the territorials as well, and those guys in the TA now and girls are doing much more than they used to do. But it's not so long ago that the TA was 80,000 strong.
On paper, anyway.
Yes, that, of course, always was the problem, wasn't it, Bob? Mm. That you had these sort of ghost people in the TA who sort of turned up, and a few of whom may have been using it more as a drinking club than anything else.
In 2007, I did a report on reservists serving in Iraq. I discovered that probably only 7,000 or 8,000 of the 30,000 on paper were deployable. Quite frankly, that's not going to be enough. That we are talking now of 30,000 deployable people. I think they'll be extremely lucky to get it by 2018. Therefore, the plan looks doomed to failure, and I'm not very happy about it at all, and I've said so in Parliament.
Well, do you know, can I pick up on that point? Bob, Mike said to you that he doesn't think we've got enough soldiers and British military personnel to defend the nation. You've agreed with him. How does that make you feel as a Conservative MP?
Very sad, because, you know, the Conservatives are meant to be the party of defence.
And they're not?
They want to be. They can't be. I mean, you can't just actually conjure up money. It's extremely difficult for Philip Hammond because the pressure on budgets is so enormous. You can only defend a country if the country's viable. At the moment, our country is increasingly not viable, and we've got to get that sorted out.
Where do you draw this line, Bob? Because essentially, I tell you, if you, in fact, if we got rid of the army, maybe had 10,000, we get loads more hospitals, we get loads more, you know, education and that sort of thing. Mm. There does come a cut-off point where you say this is dangerous. Surely,
well, it's dangerous now. It's dangerous because we just don't have enough soldiers. I haven't even mentioned the Royal Navy. I mean, the Royal Navy is going to be down to about 23,000, 24,000, is Mike. And then that's not including the Royal Marines. And the Royal Air Force is going to be about 40,000. And we just don't have enough.
Yeah, I mean, we have tiny numbers of ships and planes now. It's really quite scary. I think the other thing which is very important in this discussion is that since the end of national service, the public really have very little contact with the army, and they don't, and what the service is generally, and they don't really understand the issues. I mean, they may have some, you know, knowledge of what's going on in places like Afghanistan, but the public really are not connected to the forces as they were.
I mean, let me just put it this way. On the 6th of December 1982, as a company commander in Ireland, I had 6 men killed from my company. Those 6 men were buried within the small county of Cheshire. Everyone knew those people one way or other. Now, recruits come from everywhere, and actually the sort of link between the locals and the regular army is pretty remote. And as the reserve army is forming up, they're making it even less close because they're talking about having regional training centres for the reserve army, which will mean the closure of places like, I'm thinking of Cheshire, Sandbach, Crewe, Stockport. These places may well be closed down. And that means that the territorial army aren't there among the people. And we need people's support. They need to see soldiers to actually have that connection, as well as the sort of the heart connection of our soldiers are being hurt. You actually want a personal connection to the armed forces as well. And I think you'll agree with that, Mike.
Yes, I do. And I think this business of cutting local connections, amalgamating regiments, all the sort of things that are going on at the moment, all has a generally very negative effect on the way the public actually perceive the army. Yes, of course, there's tremendous concern about guys getting killed in Afghanistan. It is, and it's great to see the public really feeling for what's happening, and it's quite clear that that is the case. But at a deeper level, they don't really understand the issues of defence now, because so few people are involved in defence or have been involved in defence or military service. And this is a very serious issue and concerns me greatly for the future, because it means in a way that the politicians can get away with cuts that go beyond what's safe. And most people really don't understand the implications of it.
Michael, you're chatting obviously directly with Colonel Bob Stewart, member of the Defence Select Committee, backbencher within the Conservative Party, of course. And it has to be said, a very independently minded backbencher. I will make that point.
I think we both share that, Sean.
Well, but do you? Well, absolutely.
As independently minded people who don't necessarily always rise as far as they might because they will state their mind. But you need people like that in the society,
particularly
at the moment.
Do you have any truck with his argument that actually you do need to say, well, look, yeah, OK, you could have a bigger defence, but, you know, something would have to give elsewhere in the budget?
Basically, we live in an uncertain world. And we're back to some sort of tripwire or MAD, mutually assured destruction situation, ultimately, because we don't have enough guys on the ground to defend the country. So, sadly, we do still need our nuclear deterrent, because there are scenarios one could imagine where it might just have to be used. Let's, God forbid, that that should be the case. But if you cut the army and the other services to the sort of levels that we're cutting it to now, you become more dependent on weapons of mass destruction, not less. You've also got to think about what would happen if we ended up with another crisis or another two crises somewhere in the world. How on earth would we manage? We now become far more dependent on our allies. We're in a position where we can't really take independent action. You know, things like the Falklands probably wouldn't be a possibility anymore. So we are in a much more vulnerable state than we used to be. And I think in the simplest of terms, we're now going through that boundary. We just don't have enough people. We are in a dangerous situation now. And yes, if there have to be cuts in other areas, so be it, because there comes a point where you just cannot cut them anymore. And we've come to that point and we have cut them too far.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
Michael Yardley there, former British officer, contributing author to the Oxford History of the British Army. He says that we are in a dangerous position and we simply don't have enough numbers, Bob. And frankly, he writes off the notion of having to readjust budgets. He says defence is more important than it's clearly regarded.
Yes, he's right. It must be regarded at a much higher... Here's the problem. In Europe, normally there's been a major war 7 times in a century. Mm. We haven't had a major war since the Second World War, and it's well outside my lifetime. We're approaching 70 years now. So the trouble is the public aren't reminded of what the situation could be like because of our recent history has not included that sort of situation.
You sound awfully conflicted, because what you're actually doing is making the point I was going to make, is that we have a really vital responsibility that some would argue we're not fulfilling.
It is a vital responsibility, and it's a responsibility that makes me extremely sad. The first duty of government is the defence of the nation.
Are they failing in that duty?
No, they're not failing. They're doing their very best. But if the state is in peril because it's imploding, the first duty of government is the defence of the nation. But if the nation's in peril because actually it's utterly and completely broke, we've got to put that right. So that's the dilemma.
All right. Well, actually, as you'll imagine, obviously, there are various views on this particular point, Bob. Let's bring in now Jim Murphy, Labour Shadow Defence Secretary. Jim, Colonel Bob Stewart's with us. We've been hearing about his dilemma of getting the budgets right to ensure that we have a sufficient defence force. But he acknowledges that he's slightly conflicted on that himself.
I understand his concerns and I share quite a lot of them. The government had a defence review back in 2010, and it wasn't about defence strategy at all. It was about how to make cuts. And we all know that savings have to be made. Of course we do. But they made cuts that were at best tactical and certainly weren't strategic. And it wasn't based upon the needs of the nation or the changing nature of the world. It was based upon what could they cut most quickly. How else do you end up with an aircraft carrier with no aeroplanes on it?
I don't disagree with Jim. You know, the biggest problem we've got is how we are actually going to man up by 2020. How are we going to man, equip, and if necessary, fight? We don't want to fight. We don't want to use our nuclear deterrent. We talked about the use of the nuclear deterrent. The nuclear deterrent is used every day.
Well, that's certainly an argument to have with Liberal Democrats. You've obviously spoken quite a bit, Jim, about the military covenant.
The point is that as the armed forces get smaller, paradoxically, the affection for them is broader, certainly in my life. Now, Bob's a little older than me, but perhaps even in his life, the kind of degree of affection and depth and breadth of affection and respect for armed forces has kind of a high point. And my argument is that there's no guarantee that as Afghan operations wind down, and as Bob says, hopefully we're not engaged elsewhere in the world, there's an issue of could there be a drop-off? And I think we take this opportunity at the moment to put new laws in place at a local level and a national level to protect our armed forces and their families permanently. And that's why the Armed Forces Covenant's important, but I want us to see it go further I want us to be doing more to support veterans who are out of work, who are the minority, of course. Most veterans find jobs, but the minority who find it more difficult, to give them guaranteed job interviews and other measures such as that.
OK, well, look, you speak on the military covenant, of course. You speak on ideological cuts without wishing to put words in your mouth. You can correct me if I'm wrong on that one. But what are the key areas that you think are actually endangering the nation in terms of defence?
Well, I didn't say ideological, of course. I did say it was tactical, like strategy. It didn't. The government, in a rush, didn't properly scan the world in which we were living in and about to live through. And when the Strategic Defence Review doesn't even mention Libya or Tunisia, if you look back over the last couple of years, the world events, then there's no guarantee you can see into the future. But it just lacked any sense of strategy. Now, where are the problems? I think the issue is, as we continue to cut the military, particularly at the moment with the army, we're not effective enough as a country yet to increase the reservists to fill that space.
We were talking about that. Bob was saying it's unrealistic that we might get 30,000.
Well, I'm afraid Jim's right. I mean, Jim, in my view, is a superb Shadow Defence Secretary. I just want to point out he's the only politician I know, this is buffing you up, Jim, the only politician I know that's been down to visit the Royal Marines, gone on a run with them and beaten the pants off the lot of them. They are really seriously jarred off by that, Jim. I can't remember what I was answering then, but whatever it was, it's the same as Jim.
that's nice, actually, a bit of consensus in terms of defence. I think the problem is, actually, an awful lot of people listening to here, now, they will kind of have this slight sense that everybody's saying, yes, we're deeply concerned about, you know, defence in the United Kingdom, but we also understand that there's an issue with the economy. So if we're saying, Bob, you said earlier that we need to make sure that we have a nation that's worth defending. So that's the now. Where is the plan for the future when the economy is supposedly fixed?
Well, when the economy's fixed, we've got to do a lot of things. For example, the biggest threat, the biggest gap in our capabilities right at this moment, and this is what the whole of the Defence Committee think, is the fact that we don't have a maritime patrol aircraft. Mm. This is actually wrong, and we ought to get it right. We ought to start buying something before the next SDSR in 2015. We do not have the ability to look over the seas for which we have responsibility, or indeed under them. I don't know what Jim's view on that is, but that's mine.
I think it is a really significant capability gap. The kind of previous programme was, of course, over budget, but when the government came to power, it was chopped up like a second-hand car, billions of pounds thrown away. How do you fill that gap at a time when finances are tough? It's a big question. There's people are lobbying me that some of this could be done with unmanned aerial vehicles, drones, in the way that normal people can describe it. And we're looking at just how do you fill this gap? Because it's undoubtedly there. And an ability to patrol our own waters from the air is a very important point in our strategic defence.
So fair point for the coalition, though, Jim, to say, well, you know, technology is changing. There are things that we can do that don't necessarily need feet on the ground.
The nature of conflict, the nature of armed forces is changing, and it always does change. And that's the criticism, which is that the military plan for the previous battle rather than the next one. But technology is driving change at such a pace that you can do many more things with fewer people, but you can't do it without people.
All right, that's
the important point.
Lastly, Jim Murphy, Labour Shadow Defence Secretary, comprehensive spending review on the way. What's your advice to George Osborne specifically when it comes to defence in the United Kingdom?
Well, the most important defence policy, I think, you could argue, is an economic policy. If you have economic growth back in the country, then more people at work paying taxes, fewer people taking benefit, you have a greater degree of confidence. And then, if you like, the size of the fiscal cake would be larger. But on defence, I think, in a specific point, I think if the government was to, and I've no sense that this is on the cards, if they were to make further reductions in forces welfare, are significant changes. We've already seen changes to pension entitlements and some changes on housing that have basically their cuts. And I think if they go further than that, I think the country would scratch its head with a sense of the government's lost its way and doesn't know the difference between right and wrong when it comes to treatment of our armed forces sometimes.
Hear, hear with Sean Dilley on Audio Boo.
The danger that the government might not know the difference between right and wrong. That was quite a strong message from Jim Murphy, Bob.
Actually, Jim and I are not far apart. We are quite bipartisan in defence. Certainly, between the Labour Party and the Conservative Party, the Liberals slightly have a different view. And of course, we're in coalition with the Liberals, which actually constrains us quite a lot. And the particular bone of contention in defence is, of course, the independent nuclear deterrent and its requirement. Once you get out, you'll never get back in. Why is it that so many countries want to have nuclear weapons? And I don't think for the relatively small amount of money, we're talking about 6% of the defence budget over the 30 years in the future, we do retain the independent nuclear deterrent. It does allow us to have a seat at the top table. It is the ultimate deterrent. And people are wrong to think that it's not in use. It is in use every single day. People know that they cannot attack our country with impunity.
I asked Jim Murphy his advice, his plea to George Osborne ahead of the comprehensive spending review later this month, specifically on defence, all right? Not so much the wider economy, but what would your appeal to the Chancellor be on defence?
Leave it as it is, but actually give it a little bit more money so that we can buy a maritime patrol aircraft, so that that would actually fill the capability gap we've got there. We should have a proper expeditionary capability back in our country with really modern aircraft carrier.
Just before we move on to some of the picks of the week that are unrelated, there are an awful lot of personnel being made redundant, particularly at a time when recruiting is still ongoing. How would you describe the fairness of that process?
Well, the armed forces are constrained by the numbers, the sort of top-level numbers they can have. You don't really want to make redundant the young soldiers, sailors and airmen, because they are the lifeblood of actually the armed forces. What you have got to do is to take out or ask to be redundant, hopefully voluntarily, those people that are coming towards the end of their service. Top ranks.
But it's not all voluntary,
services.
And this is the point.
Of course it's not.
But you look at your own circumstance. Can you imagine, like, a couple of years off your full pension entitlements, if you get a letter in the post, thanks for risking your life for us, but now go away?
Well, of course I understand that. And I'm particularly concerned about people within 2 years of being made redundant of getting a pension entitlement. And in fact, not just myself, but the Defence Committee have been arguing with the Minister of Defence on this matter, because we're talking particularly about officers. People think officers are all ultra-rich sometimes. They're not. I'm thinking particularly in terms of captains and majors within 2 years of their pension date. Therefore, they don't quite get the pension. They get it in another form. They get it in a lump sum. They get it like that, but it's not quite the same. And frankly, I would prefer to see that sorted out.
OK, picks of the week, or the topics of the moment, if you like. We were chatting about the Bilderberg Group earlier, held in Watford, of course.
Well, I just think it's a private meeting. It doesn't cost the taxpayer anything.
Well, it cost £2 million out of the police budget, that we know about.
Well, let's put it this way. If people were coming into our country, some of these VIPs, they'd have to have security. Now, frankly, I would like the costs of, you know, the policing to be placed at someone else's door,
They're contributing. The Bilderberg Group are contributing, but certainly these are very wealthy individuals. I'll tell you what sticks in...
The point is there wouldn't be a policing problem if people weren't protesting about a private meeting where actually people are just discussing the situation. For goodness sake.
But how do you know what goes on with the very greatest respect
to you? Honestly,
this
is silly. I can't see.
Bob.
Yeah, well, I can tell you, honestly, Sean.
Yeah.
I mean, these guys are meant to be influential people in the world. They're getting together to discuss. I don't know. I don't care. All I know is, as a politician...
You don't care about the transparency?
Yeah, no, let them have that. It's not... I care when I actually see any impact. Someone coming out of that meeting and saying the Bilderberg Group said we ought to do this and this is what we're going to do. No, of course they're not. And the people that run the country, hopefully, are in Parliament. Of course, people from Parliament, I mean, on both sides of the political divide, attended that. You know, Rory Stewart, my friend Rory Stewart, went to it a few years ago. I know other people that have been there. I've never been invited. You know what? I don't care. Am I bothered? No, I'm bloody
not. You
say
you're not, but look, I want to stick on this issue of transparency for a moment, Bob. I appreciate it. I'm probably being tiresome with it. But the point is the Chancellor, OK, the Shadow Chancellor, but actually also the Prime Minister, they're attending in time that they would otherwise be governing the country more generally. Something on the Chatham House rule, i.e. you cannot breathe a word about it. It is highly cloaked in secrecy. Now, you say it's a private meeting, but it's a very, very high-profile public meeting. Is
private.
It not right that there should be some accountability to Parliament?
Well, if it was involved at governmental level, yes. But
well,
it isn't.
The Prime Minister was there as
well,
head of government.
Well, I mean, the Prime Minister also has the right to have a private life. I tell you what is good about this. Yeah. if they can actually sit there in a relaxed way and think about how we might find some solutions for the problems of the world, and any one of them comes back. I mean, I listened to Ken Clark in Parliament the other day. He said this is what he gets out of it. He goes there, there's no pressure, he listens and he thinks, what can we do to get things better for all people in the world? That sounds to me like quite a good thing to do.
I don't doubt it, by the way. I mean, not that my view is important as a mere presenter in this circumstance, but there is an issue where it's secret. It's as simple as that. The public are deeply suspicious when it comes to something that they're not prepared to say, yes, here's what we discussed, here's how we can boost the economy. Why does it need to be secret?
Why there are so-called Chatham House rules, I presume, is because actually, if you didn't have those, people would be rushing out of there and quoting and mouthing off about what people have said, what people have speculated. And that's just mad. There have to be some sort of secrets in this world so that actually people can, in this case, probably speak their mind without the risk of someone rushing out and saying, Mr. X, Miss X said this, isn't this appalling?
OK, fair enough. Well, this has been a Hear Hear special on defence. If we had a year, I don't think we'd have enough time to address all the issues. But one thing's for sure, it is a deeply complicated issue. It's fine to say that defence is being let down, but also we have to bear in mind, as pointed out by Colonel Bob Stewart, the nation needs to be worth defending. And without an economy, if we crash, how can we have anything to defend? I've been Sean Dilley. This has been Audio Boo. You're listening to Hear Hear.
Hear Hear with Sean Dilley on Audioboo.